Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast, helping engineers, producers, and artists create professional recordings and mixes, even from home. I'm your host, Mike Indovina. Let's get started. Hey, welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast. My name is Mike Indovina, and thank you for hanging out with me today. Today, my guest is Alex Gamble. And if you're not familiar with Alex, Alex is an engineer based out of the Toronto area who has worked with some amazing artists such as Fucked Up, Broken Social Scene, Arkells, Sarah Harmer, Always, and a whole bunch more. And not only is Alex a great engineer, but he's also a great mixer as well. And he does a lot of work these days mixing for Dolby Atmos. So yeah, we definitely get into that in this conversation here today. And one of the great things about Alex is that you can tell he's very meticulous with his process. He's thoroughly thought out every single move he takes throughout the entire production process. And he goes through a mental checklist of decisions that ultimately help get the artist the sound that they want. And you're going to hear him talk about his process for what kind of conversations he has with artists early on, and then how he maps out the game plan and what thoughts are going through his head as he's dealing with setting up the instruments, setting up the microphones, and all of those decisions that you need to take in order to get the sound you want. And I just think that Alex does such a great job of breaking down his thought process, and you can absolutely take what he talks about here and apply it to your own productions, even if you're working in a home studio. And one of the really cool things about this is that Alex works with a lot of different artists in different genres. So everything he's talking about here can absolutely apply to different genres of music too. So yeah, I think you're going to really, really enjoy this episode and find a lot of gold in it. So with that said, let's just jump into it. Alex Gamble, thank you so much for being on the Master Your Mix podcast. How's it going, man?
It's going great. Thanks for having me, Mike.
Of course. For people who might not be familiar with you and what you do and how you got into all this stuff, can you give us that story?
All right. Well, let's start at the start. I'm Alex Gamble. I'm based in Toronto, Ontario. I've been working as an audio engineer, mixer, producer, and more recently a Dolby Atmos mixer for the last 10 years or so professionally, although I've been into music and been into production much before that. Before I got started on this professionally, I was actually a mechanical engineer. So I went to university for that, and where I studied for 5 years, and then actually worked 5 years professionally as a mechanical engineer to the point where I got a full professional engineer designation. I could stamp fancy documents and do all that sort of stuff. But I realized pretty quickly into it, I was good at it from a technical perspective. I've always been good at math. I've been good at concepts and complicated flow of signals and how things interact, but I just wasn't super passionate about what I was doing, despite maybe being decent at it. On the side, I'd always been into music, and I was playing in bands, and pretty early on, like on my first studio experience with one of those early bands, I really connected with what was going on that side of music creation. The amount of things you can do to create size in a production and really make it anything that you want it to be. Not necessarily for the sake of doing something that you can't do, but you know, one of the things that I noticed from like recording demos with my bands in the early days is that if we just sort of set up and went live off the floor in our buddy's basement with a recorder, you know, it didn't sound that great, but and when we get into a proper studio and we learn, oh, you should double track the guitars. Oh, you should comp this and do that and add all these production layers. Then it started to make me realize, like, now it starts to feel like how I think we present our sound on stage. And, you know, that was one of my earliest experiences with it. And it was just such a cool experience that I'll always remember. And I've always had been kind of chasing getting that since. And so from that experience onward, I decided to, like, got to get into it myself, bought like a little bit of gear, basic recorder, got a DAW up and running, and slowly kind of became the demo recording guy for other bands around town. My town at the time was St. John, New Brunswick, so there wasn't a lot of bands.
I've been there. It's a small place, but nice.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. St. John is the thriving metropolis in New Brunswick, but it's like 80,000 people. So living here in Toronto was a big adjustment, but that's another story for another day.
I have to stop you right there. Is St. John's where the, was it called the Blue Olive? Like there's like a Mediterranean restaurant that was downtown.
You got it. Yeah. Have you been there?
I've been there a couple times. Great place, great food, great people that own that place. And I know, but
they're great people that own that place. I love them. They're awesome.
Because I was tour managing for years, and one of the bands I worked with had a couple shows out there, and those guys are always just great guys. So shout out to them.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I mean, we're known for our hospitality and our friendliness. I love St. John. I go back there and visit all the time. Still got lots of friends there. All my family lives out there.
Nice.
That's where I got my start in music. But I mean, the thing was with growing up in St. John and trying to make a go of it out there, I didn't like have a lot of examples of people who are doing it professionally. Like St. John's a pretty blue collar town, and which was probably part of my decision to get into mechanical engineering, because that was an available path to somebody who was creative and technical in the way that I was. Cause there's a lot of creativity that goes into being a technical engineer with a quote real job still, but it wasn't the type of creativity that I liked and valued. And I just always enjoyed music, and I thought that I would have something to offer in that context. And so, 5 years into working as a professional, I decided, well, instead of making a go at this long term, let's save up some money and go to an audio school and really train to do this properly. And so I did that. I ended up choosing an audio school in Vancouver. It's no longer around, but when I was around, it was an awesome school called Nimbus School of Recording Arts.
Oh yeah, with Garth Richardson?
That's the one.
Nice.
I mean, it was, when I was there, that place changed my life. Like, there's no other way to put it. It absolutely changed the course of my entire life. Forget the career for a second. Like, just, it set me down a path that I just felt so good about having that experience and having been there for that intense sleepless year. My class was me and I think only six other people. And we had this amazing facility with SSL consoles. There's like a vintage G series and there was a more modern AWS one there. Awesome mic collection and several studios that were open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And my approach at that time was, I'm here, I've quit my real job with benefits to do this, so let's really do this. And so the studios were open 24 hours, and guess where I was during those 24 hours? In the studio. I'd be going around town and finding local artists and just being like, hey, let me record you for free if you're willing to stay up with me past midnight. I'm learning, bear with me, but let's go do this. And just kept hustling that way. And, you'd find willing people to do it. And I would learn that way. And when I didn't have my own artist to bring into the studio, I would just hang around the school. Somebody else would need a runner or an assistant or a tape op on their session. And I would just hop in and do it. And that's what I did for a year. Just getting my hands dirty with gear, trying things out, learning from experience, learning from failing, which is the best way to learn. I'm sure glad I got the experience to do that while I was in school instead of in a professional environment. So I made sure while that opportunity was available to me that I seized the moment and did it. And that was 10 years ago. I graduated from there in 2014, and here we are in 2024. And I still haven't had to go back to my real job. I'm still here as an audio engineer and producer.
Love it.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And I think I have to say, I think you took the right approach there too. Like, for people who are thinking about going to the audio colleges and stuff like that, it really does come down to you're going to learn the basics while you're there. But if you really want to get the most out of it, you have to be the person like yourself that, is there all the time and always trying to collaborate with other people and really network and just get as much experience as you can. Because when you have that in front of you, why not take advantage of it? Because once you're out, you might lose all chances to make those mistakes and all that kind of stuff.
And you're not going to realize how much of a luxury you had. Like, even if your school doesn't have the most amazing gear, if you've got studio time and the opportunity to use it, go use it. Like, that's how you're going to do the best learning. The book knowledge is one thing, and it's important. All the concepts are super critical to get, but I kind of liken it to learning while awake and how you kind of cement your learning with dreaming. As an aside, I've got a year and a half old now, so I've been reading a lot about how kids learn, and apparently kids learn a ton when they go to sleep. They take all the stuff that they learn throughout the day, and it's almost like it writes it into the RAM of their brain.
Interesting.
While they're sleeping. So instead of sleeping, I was in the studio.
There you go, yeah.
And that was kind of my sleep learning. You have to, by going and doing it and applying it, it took those conceptual points that I learned, in the class, and just cemented them. Yeah. And also you get the chance to learn mistakes, and then you can kind of make notes and be like, all right, I'm going to change my workflow. I'm going to make this kind of template. I'm going to set the console up like this and just learn by doing. It's so important. And yeah, the audio schools, I get asked all the time, should I go to an audio school to do this? And it's like, the answer is always yes and no. If you do go, as you said, it's all in your hands what you're going to get out of it. Just go and make the most of it. It was an awesome experience for me. And I wouldn't be where I was today without having it, because when I was there, I met Leon Tani, who eventually became one of the co-founders of Union Sound Company, which is a studio in Toronto here, that I was their very first intern. I got placed as an intern at another studio through the audio school. Leon went there, and then he's like, man, you're cool. If you ever want to come to Toronto and help us build a studio, we'd love the help, which was enough for me to pack up my car and all my belongings and come here.
Love it.
With no real guarantees, but it ended up working out, because for the first 5 years of that studio's existence, I helped build the place. I became their first intern. I became an assistant engineer and eventually a staff engineer there, and made so many connections that I still keep to this day. Learned so many things, got to work with so many producers, be on some really, really cool records. I got to work with Always there. I got to work with Pup, Broken Social Scene there. You know, some of these bands were my heroes, people I never thought I would ever get to meet or have access to, let alone be in a studio with, making a record with. Those are amazing experiences, being there. So that was the first 5 years of my career, was really just being there and being the staff guy in a studio. You know, it's going to be a different thing every day, because it's usually bands coming in to record stuff they need the big studio for. So usually bands are coming in to do their bed tracking, drums, bass, live vocals, that sort of thing. And then once in a while you get the longer term lockouts, where you actually really get to see a project be built from the ground up, from conception to realization.
Yeah.
Those ones were rare, but I got to see a handful of those. Broken Social Scene, for example, was there for roughly a month. So was Pup. And yeah, just got to see so many different ways of working. Being an assistant engineer in a studio, really, you can benefit a lot just by A, being useful. That means you get to stay in the room. And B, if you're in the room and you're not being asked to run the whole show, just make sure you're supporting it really well. I think a lot of people have trouble with that early on when they get their first internship. They want to jump in and they want to produce and they want to do the whole thing. If you just be chill, be in the corner, be serving the session, don't be on your phone, you're going to learn so much. You have an opportunity to witness record making from people that have been doing this for a very long time that nobody else is going to get. You're not going to get that on YouTube videos. You're not going to get that, on your mix with the master sort of thing. You're in there while a record is being made. It's an immense privilege. And I definitely benefited a lot from the opportunity to be that person in the room.
Love it. Yeah, it's very cool. You kind of mentioned an idea that I was curious to ask you, which is that
you know, you said that by assisting there, you got to see a lot of different styles of production and how other engineers worked. And, you know, I was curious to know about that and like your experience with that, because, yeah, you see, you know, maybe different ways that people mic up a drum kit or different ways that maybe, you know, some people record things like individually or live off the floor or, you know, like different mic positions, all sorts of stuff that goes into it. So as far as like taking those ideas and then like developing them into your own, you know, like how... Like, do you feel like you have like kind of like a standard way that you like to do things now after you've like experimented with all these different things? Or are you now like that kind of person that's just like always experimenting and trying different things?
It's less about experimenting and more about, I've seen a lot of ways that it can be done, either by having been in the room and seen it done or by trying it. Having that experience has told me that there are a lot of different ways of doing it. And different projects, different artists, different people might respond better or worse to those different ways of doing it. So when I get asked now as a freelance engineer or freelance producer to come in and do a project, my approach usually is to sit and talk with them. I want to talk about what their goals are for the music. What kind of production do they want for the music? What's some music that they like? And I also want to talk a little bit about what their previous studio experience has been, what they've liked about it, what they've disliked about it, what worked, what didn't. And then I just want to talk about some different approaches and see what they're resonating with. And it always becomes a balance of, A, what's going to make that person the most creative? So for example, vocalist is a big one. I find recording vocals is a lot less about the right mic choice and the right compressor choice and more just like how dim the lights are, things like that. Just making sure that they've got, an environment to deliver the best possible performance in. Cause at the end of the day, if they belt the most awesome take into an SM58, it's going to sound so much better than if they were feeling self-conscious and uncomfortable in front of an M49. You know what I mean?
Yep.
A lot of it comes down to trying to read what I think is going to get the best possible performance out of people. Some vocalists like to go in after the instrumental is fully cut and even mixed a little bit and then cut their vocals to that. I've had some vocalists where we'll set them off live off the floor and they'll be getting it on take one because to them, it's like they're on stage again. And when they're on stage, they're the most comfortable and they're delivering their best. Having a talk about what's going to create that environment is key. And then also having the flexibility and the humility within the moment to realize, is this working? And if it isn't, what do we got to change about it? So there isn't a specific process I like to do. I'm not like a let's always do stuff live off the floor kind of person. I'm not a let's always do things separate kind of person. I think every project is unique. And there's so many moving parts into what's going to get the best result, and the result matters. So I feel lucky that I've got all these different types of workflows at my disposal from having experienced them. And so it's all about talking with the artist and then pulling the right tools out of the toolkit to be able to tailor a recording that's going to work for them.
I love that. And I think that's a really good lesson for people is like, all it takes is that simple conversation. Because like you could like lose an amazing artist just because you did things your way and you didn't take the 10 minutes to have a conversation with an artist to discover what they really want and what their previous experience was and all that kind of stuff. I think that's such a big telling question to like ask someone what their previous experience in a studio was like, because right from there you learn immediately what not to do, and just by not doing that you've already created a better experience, hopefully, you know. So
hopefully, yeah, I mean there's two sides to it too. I've always prided myself on doing what we just talked about. I'm starting to get a little bit better now at also understanding that as much as I like to think that I'm just this sort of like transparent part of the process and I'll do whatever's going to get the job done and just be easy about it, I'm starting to get a little bit more in touch with the fact that there's also certain things I need as well to make something happen. Usually from the mixing perspective, like for example, I'm learning about myself that when I'm building a mix, I usually like to do the technical stuff myself. I get really self-conscious if somebody is sitting in the room with me and I'm trying to like figure out if I should notch 2 dB or 2.2 dB from 650 hertz. Like, you know, I can't focus on that stuff if somebody's watching me. And so I'm starting to also get a little bit better of being like, all right, you're bringing me in as a creative collaborator. Also, here's what I need. Not in the context of I want to take over the process and interfere with it, but let's also just like respect each other and what's going to help me help you get the best result. So there's that side of it as well. It's absolutely a balance. Like you gotta work together in the end.
Totally, right? It's like, to your point, when you're having those conversations with people, it's about making them feel comfortable and in order to get the best out of them. And so it's reciprocated when they let you do things the way you need to do it in order to get the best results for them again. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And usually before I embark on, you know, things like mixing, it's another conversation. What are mixes you like? What are songs you like? Okay, this song sounds nothing like your music. Next, like those sorts of things.
Yeah. Well, I think that's one of the fun things about production too, is that there's like, artists are so critical of themselves. And at the same time, they also, a lot of artists find that they're like, they think that they're like super unique in the sense that like no other artist sounds anything like me. I have no other influences, but really, mm-hmm. like, let's be real. They're comparing their music against something else when they leave the studio. So it's like, you got to get clear on what those things are and what people's expectations of the music are. And you know, if there's a modern artist that you're working with, like if they say they want to sound like Led Zeppelin or whatever, like, do they really want to sound like Led Zeppelin, or is it just like an album that they're inspired by, you know?
Exactly. I mean, yes. Some people are really good at the whole referencing thing, I think is what we're referring to. Like, some people are really like, I wrote a track like this, here's a track like this that I like the sound of. And it's just like, cool, that was very clear, thank you. And then sometimes it's like, we go and record a track and then they give me a reference list of music they like. It sounds nothing like their music. In those situations, I'm not doing the thing where I like bring a WAV file of that into the session and like A/B it, because it's pointless, because you're not going to make it sound like that. But I try to get into the music and get in touch with what I'm feeling when I listen to it, and how can I bring that into this world. With references specifically, I like to have those before the recording even, because that's going to impact decisions that you make early on. You know, I get into trouble sometimes with stuff that I get where I'm just the mixer. And they'll send me the multi-track and it'll all sound really good, like raw, but, and they'll be like, here's what we were going for. And it's like, well, oh, man, that snare drum's like tight and disco-y, and you know, your snare drum rings for like 5 seconds. So what are we going to do about that? And, you know, so when I usually am engineering on a project from the beginning, that chat about references happens early on. And I usually ask people to send me like a little Spotify playlist of what they're listening to and that sort of thing. And then have another chat of like, okay, what can we pull from these influences? And then eventually, like, the whole referencing game just kind of fades to the back, because sort of gather that information. Hopefully you've made some good decisions to this point, and then you've created a song that's living on its own as what it is. And you're just trying to make it the best version of what it is at that point, instead of chasing something constantly.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Like, you do need to think about those references very early, right? Before you even record that first note, because it's like, that's going to dictate the sound of the record from there. And like, you can't be fixing it in the mix and changing up tones in the mix. That's not the point of mixing, you know? So when you get it right at the source, that's what it's all about, which coincidentally is also what my new book, The Recording Mindset, is all about. It's all about understanding that stuff at the beginning, getting clear on it, and then figuring out the process to get you those results. So just got to take a second to make that little promo.
That is great knowledge to share. And that is accurate knowledge. I mean, I look at it like building a house. Like, you lay that foundation first and then build everything on top of that. But, you know, you're in a whole heap of trouble if you got a house built and then you're just like, you know what? Let's dig the basement deeper.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's a little tricky to do that. It's not to say it can't be done, but boy, oh boy, it might not be the best way to do it.
Totally. I love that, man. I think it's super important to get clear on that vision early on, so you know what to execute, how to execute it. And I'm curious to know too, like, you work with, you mentioned some artists earlier, like you work in a variety of different genres with a lot of different artists of different styles. Mm-hmm. Like, as far as changing your production style to suit those unique genres, like those different genres and stuff like that, do you feel like is it just the same process every time? It's just still having these conversations? Or do you feel like you are changing your processes depending on certain genres and that kind of thing?
It can be genre dependent for sure. For example, like, you know, making a djent album versus like making a jazz album are going to be two very different things. Like if it was like a very traditional jazz ensemble, like I would suggest to them, let's do this thing live off the floor. Go rehearse a bunch, get your performances really, really tight, and let's go into the studio and let's do it live off the floor. And in some cases, even with some of you in the same room. But if I was, you know, doing a metal record where they want to sound like your Deftones or something like that, that's a whole different process. I mean, be like, all right, let's just do drums. Let's rent a wicked kit. Let's put fresh skins on it. Let's really get an awesome drum sound. Let's edit it tight. And then let's do the next thing. So it's different, definitely different processes for different genres. And I do like hopping around to different genres. It's one thing that I really enjoy doing. I think as a bit of a Libra, my personality type is that I'll just kind of like see what other people's opinions are and be like, oh yeah, good point. And so I kind of take that approach to music making as well. Like for example, last week I had 7 days locked out at Union Sound Company. And for the first 4 days I was engineering this like super like avant-garde like project for a composer who wrote pieces for harpsichord, cello, flute, and percussion with these really crazy charts where, you know, there was notes on them of like the flute person plays 33 cents flat in this bar, like really like intense. Wow. Stuff like that. And then I struck that, and then I did 3 days with a punk band, and I love that. I love doing those things. And it's reflected in my music taste too. I'll listen to anything. That said, the downside of that is when people like are in the studio with me and they're like referencing bands and artists where you need to know it if you like really deep dove in that genre. I don't know what they're talking about. I scratch the surface and I'm like, this is cool. I like this music and I can do this. But if you're looking for a genre person for a certain genre, I might not be it. But that said, that can be a strength at times. There's an artist I work with regularly named Mark Lennon, and he's blending dance hall music with like some kind of singer-songwriter sort of stuff. One of his influences is Half Moon Run, but he's from Jamaica and he's very influenced by dance hall music from Jamaica. I told him from the start, I was like, man, listen, I'm going to be honest with you. I know next to nothing about dance hall. I know like, you know, I know Sean Paul and like, that's it. And he's like, that's fine. It's going to be okay. And in fact, it might be a strength because I think part of what he was trying to do was almost subvert expectations for that genre. And I was like, great. Listen to a bunch of dance hall, study what's going on in the mixes. And in the end, like he's coming at it from like having known the genre really well. I'm coming at it from a very technical, I've heard some good dance hall mixes and I know how to make it sound good, I think. And I think the resulting sound of it was pretty cool. So yeah, like different approaches for different genres for sure. Sometimes I always get the whole grass is greener on the other side thing where sometimes I think I should become a genre person, but I don't think that's my personality. I like hopping around. Also because you'd be surprised like what you can learn about classical recording from having done a rap mix yesterday. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I've said it before on the podcast. Like I back in the day, like I used to do a lot of like hip hop records and yeah. But I always came from like the punk and metal world myself. So like for me, like whenever I worked on those hip hop records, it was so common that I would throw like distortion on a vocal. And people would be like, what are you doing? This is incredible. And it's like, it's just distortion, man. Like,
exactly.
But it's like, and people
and maybe
to
you
it
can
at
look
time.
At that on the flip side too. And maybe in one of your metal productions, you could throw a big giant 808 in there. And maybe
exactly.
You wouldn't have done that before.
Yeah. So it's like sometimes those like different techniques can cross over and
exactly.
it just gives new life to the sounds you're working on.
Yeah. I love keeping it fresh. I love working in all sorts of different genres. All that knowledge and all those different techniques, and the techniques are different. They all feedback on each other for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One artist that you mentioned earlier that you got the chance to work with, and I love the sound of the record, is the Always record that you did.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who aren't who don't know about that record, Always is the band, Antisocialites is the record. That's an amazing record. And one of the things that I really love about that record is that it just has a really cool vibe to it overall. Like, to me, I feel
for
like
sure.
it throws back to like some 70s and 80s stuff. And like, there's just like a really cool atmosphere to it. And there's so much like interesting modulations and reverb all over the record. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the making of that record, and if there's any stories you could share about, you know, any memorable moments or maybe even challenges that went into making that record.
Yeah, for sure. So when it comes to that record, my role on it compared to the time they had spent on it to bringing it to the studio was pretty like minimal. I think they'd done the majority of the record with John Congleton, who I think was a previous guest on your podcast.
Yeah.
And they were in Toronto. I needed to retrack some drums. So they booked like 3 or 4 days at Union Sound Company to come in and do the drums. And at that point, the productions were already pretty well realized. Like, I remember when the record came out, I was like, man, this sounds like the rough mix that they brought in. Which was a really interesting perspective for me to get, because it gave me an opportunity to like look at the session and be like, ooh, they did that. Oh, I see how that's going. So really my involvement was, you know, coming in at the last minute and getting like final drum takes, that sort of thing. They had come in with Graham Walsh, and I was there as a staffer at the studio. We had recorded drums to tape. At the time, we were using a Studer A80. And so that was pretty exciting. They were pretty, like, when you walk through the lobby at Union Sound at the time when we had the tape machine, it's the first thing you see. And I think they all got pretty excited about it. And it's just like, well, let's fire this thing up. Luckily, I had been to an audio school where they taught me how to align a tape machine and all that sort of stuff. And so I knew what was going on. I strapped that thing in and set it up so that they could have 16 channels going into Pro Tools off the tape head. 16 channels going into Pro Tools that were a mirror of that, but were before tape, both as a backup and for monitoring, because if you've never recorded on tape before, what ends up happening is there's a delay. Like, when, you know, if you're just new to production and you see in your audio toolkit tape delay, like, that's a real thing. And that's because of the distance between the head that shoots the signal onto tape, and then the tape goes a little bit downstream and goes to another head that plays it back. So I set that all up for them so that they could be able to get that saturated sound of the tape and then also be monitoring it and recording it directly as a backup. And it was really cool. They banged through it. I can't remember how many songs that they redid. It might have been 4 or 5. In terms of the overall sound of that record, though, I can't take full credit for it, because they came with like a pretty detailed text document that I'm assuming John Congleton himself made of like, here's how I like drums. I'm going to need something like this on the snare. I'm going to need something like this for room mics. Make sure you grab this perspective. It was a cool learning experience to see that, actually, because it made me realize, like, if you're in charge of a project, just do whatever you got to do to get what you need. Even if it's out of your hands a little bit, like, it's okay to be like a little demanding of your collaborators on the project, because I agree that record turned out awesome. And as far as I'm aware, we gave the producer everything he needed to get great mixes on that. And I love how it turned out. Looking in their session inspired me in a lot of ways and actually taught me a bunch of techniques I use to this day. Like, for example, there were a lot of channels in the session that seemed like it was a super affected version of Molly's vocal, something that was run through like a delay pedal or something like that. And looking in the session, I was always seeing the Pro Tools faders automating up and down for these like crazy effect throws at different parts of the session. And, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. And you actually don't get to see a lot of finished products when you're working at a studio. You get used to like hearing people's rough mixes quite a bit. So that was like quite a luxury that they came in with like mixes and I got to see and hear them. That's something I still do to this day. Actually, vocal reamping is something I'm really, really big on these days. It invites like a few cool happy accidents to happen. You just take your vocal track, run it out through a space echo and back into an amp and mess around with a bunch of knobs. And then you've got this cool affected thing on a fader to push up and down in different sections.
That's very cool.
They were awesome to work with. Also Maritimers too, so we got along that way. I think.
Nice.
when you get some Maritimers in a room together, it's easy to get along. There's some commonalities that we all understand there.
Yeah, you guys are all friendly people. Yeah. Now, I was curious though, because that record, like I said, there's such a cool vibe to it, and it kind of makes sense that if it was John who sent you that list of here's how we want this recorded, they were obviously after a specific sound, and it wasn't going to be a fix it in the mix kind of thing. And I was curious to know, when it comes to your productions, whether it was on this record or any other records you've done to follow, as far as capturing the vibe of an artist and, capturing that sound, how much of it for you is done during the tracking stage versus doing it in post?
A lot is done at the tracking stage. A lot of it's going to depend on the time we have during tracking and the style of tracking that we're doing. But when time allows, and I will fight tooth and nail to get that time, you got to build it at the foundation. Again, it comes back to what I said. Once you build the house, it's tough to redo the basement from a structural perspective. You might be able to, throw some drywall on there, but, it's still going to flood if you didn't build it right. So, and as that relates to music making, all your choices for what to record are based on what you're hearing and what you want to add to the production. So if your bed track doesn't really accurately reflect what the mix is going to sound like, then how do you know what kind of what kind of sound effects you want to add to the mix? Because you're not really hearing a version of the mix yet. You're just kind of adding sound and hoping it all fits together at the end. Every choice is dependent on the choices you've already made. So make sure you're making good choices along the way. It's so, so key. Not to mention how much more inspired people are when they're hearing something in their headphones that sounds like a record. They tend to play better because they're excited about the sound of it. And, they come in the control room and they hear the take back, and instantly they're able to identify I got to go in and redo that because my performance wasn't right. And it's not just this constant guessing game of it's not mixed yet. We'll fix it later. You can just have absolute certainty that no, my timing wasn't right on the chorus. Send me back in there. I'll get it right.
Yeah. I love that. Dude, I think that's so true. And it's again, it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, where it's creating an environment for people where they're creative and where they're exactly inspired and comfortable. And so if you can get it on the way in, then that just makes people more amped about the tracks. And it brings up an interesting topic of commitment, because I know there's a lot of people who are listening to this who are maybe in the early days of recording and they're afraid to go too far with their committing because, they don't want to add too much reverb to a track or whatever it is, only to find out that it doesn't work in a mix. And so I'm curious to know, when it comes to your approach to committing to sounds that have lots of effects built in, mm-hmm. What's your typical process for knowing how far is too far?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tricky one. How far is too far? One thing that helps is having the artist in the room with you when you're doing it. If at all possible, big statement effects that I want to put in the final production, I try to at least bulk those in while I'm in a tracking or production session with the artist. That way I can look back on them in the chair back there, and if there's a big smile on their face, I know it's good. And if they're just on their phone and disconnected, it's just you know what? Maybe I'm just noodling on something that isn't good. So that feedback from the artist really, really helps. Because if I just track everything raw and don't do any of that stuff early on and then just try to do it all on my own in the room, I'm constantly second guessing myself of are they going to like this? Aren't they going to like this? Whereas if I just spend 2 minutes on an idea while they're sitting there, I get that feedback right away. And it also tells me a lot about what they might going forward in the mixing process. So maybe I'm not trying those ideas necessarily to keep them wholesale, but maybe I'm just trying a few things to just see what they're reacting to, give me a vibe for their tastes, and then go from there. As far as committing those things, you know, a lot of it takes experience. The sort of things that I'll commit on a recording would be like the sound of it. I mean, I know that sounds obvious, but you know, a lot of people ask, well, do you use EQ on the way in? Do you use compression on the way in? And my answer is, if that's what the sound requires. And you start to know what the sound requires by having done a bunch of recording and having done a bunch of mixing. So my advice is just do it a lot. Try it. Try committing something and just seeing what happens. Do a save as of your session so you can go back, but pretend like you can't. Because it'll be better for your creativity if you can just commit something and move on. When it comes to recording, I do have a bit of an order of operations for how I like to approach getting my sound. I try to do it at the source first. Like, it usually goes in the order of signal flow. So forget about microphones for a second. Let's say we're recording an acoustic guitar. Okay. Is that acoustic guitar in tune? Is it a good quality acoustic guitar? If it isn't, is the jankiness of it appealing and charming, or is it just crappy and broken? Are there new strings on it? Should there be new strings on it? All those questions. Is the thing I'm recording the right thing? Does it sound right in the room? Start there. Move down the signal chain. Let's choose a microphone or microphones and a miking technique that's going to get what I want from it. So do I want it to be super intimate? That's the case. Maybe just one mono mic, super up close. Do I want it to sound like it's in a big room? Okay, maybe I'd blend some room mics with it. Is it supposed to be a reverby splashy thing? Okay, maybe I send to an analog spring reverb and capture that on a track. So notice I haven't talked about EQ or compression at all yet. This is all just like very fundamental recording stuff. A lot of the time, if you make those choices right, you don't have to do any. I read somewhere that on Neve consoles that Rupert Neve would refer to the EQ as corrective EQ. And I try to use that mindset when I reach for an EQ. I'm not necessarily doing it for the sound, but I'm doing it to correct something that's wrong. So what's wrong? And do I have to correct it here? Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes you've done everything you can at the source. And for style reasons, you want to boost a bunch of high end or cut some low end or make it thin or, you know, do something with circuitry that you can't do with actual physics of sound. Then I would reach for something like that. And that's usually an aesthetic decision. Same with compression. You know, compression, what is it? It is when a sound gets to a certain level, a compressor reacts and turns the sound down. Do I want that to happen and why? Are the questions I'm asking myself. When you're starting out, it might take you a long time to answer those questions. So if you're not in a high pressure situation, take the time to answer those questions to yourself in your head. Why are you reaching for that compressor? It could be that you just want the tone of the compressor. That's fine. I do it all the time. LA2As, just going through them and not compressing, sounds awesome. I know a guitarist I work with, when I worked with him for the first time at Union Sound Company, I put his guitar through an LA3A, didn't compress at all. And he's just like, how come my guitar here sounds so much better than every other studio? And I'm like, check out the signal chain. Now he's out buying LA3As to record his guitar at home. maybe you want to control the dynamics of something. Okay, so that's cool. But can you do it with your performance? And if you do it with your performance, does it sound better than doing it with a compressor? Or maybe you want to completely upend a sound and distort it. That's another thing you can do with compressors. If that's a sound you know you're just going to want to have, and you've got something available to you that will do it, whether it's in a rack or whether it's on your UAD Apollo, grab it and do it. The earlier you can hear that sound, the more it's going to influence how you perform that part and how you perform subsequent parts that build on top of that. Order of operations is basically order of signal flow for me. A lot of the time, I won't record with any EQ and compression, but when it needs it, I'm not afraid to grab it.
I love that. I think that that's you know, that is the thought process people should be having about this. And I think truthfully, like, the most experienced engineers in the world do have that exact same process, maybe sometimes even like acknowledging that they're thinking all those details through.
Right.
Like, sometimes it just seems like second nature to us. But that's just because, like, when you're that experienced, like, your gut tells you exactly, like, okay, this is what I've seen happen in the past with this scenario. I'm going to do this, you know, like, you just, you're reacting to it. But I think that it is very important for people, especially early on, to like really think through their decisions. And the way you broke down your process there, I think is very helpful for people listening to this.
Yeah. And I try to think about those things all the time. And as you mentioned, maybe not necessarily while the session is happening, but like, maybe the day after a session, I reflect on like a choice I made for recording a certain instrument. And I think back, how could I have improved that? And really try to get down to the fundamentals of engineering for why you made that decision and what a better decision might be in the future. I'm thinking about that stuff all the time, maybe too much time, but the way I think about it is take that time to do that. Like, whether it's like just thinking about a better way to do something or reading up about different workflows or different mixing techniques. But then when it's time to actually be creative, just go. And that technique that you like overthought the other day might come up and it might not, but it's always good to like go through that process mentally, because when you do get into those creative bursts, you're going to get better results out of them every time from having gone through those like almost workflow internal audits.
Of course. Yeah. Makes sense. No, I love that. Well, one instrument that I was curious to ask you about with regards to your process and how you like to do things yourself. And this is just a selfish thing, me being a drummer. Like, I love the sound of your drums. I think your drums sound awesome. And snare is always that elusive thing that I chase, the perfect snare tone for.
The perfect snare tone.
It just doesn't exist, but it's like the... It's the thing everyone strives for. But on a lot of records that you've worked on, one of the things that I've noticed is that your snares tend to have like really nice fat tones to them that sound really big and deep. And I'm curious to know, like, when it comes to recording drums, maybe specifically snare in this case here, do you have like a kind of like your instinctive process that you like to do with snares? Are you like saturating your drums on the way in? Is it more of a tuning thing? Like, what is that kind of mental checklist for a snare for you?
Definitely tuning is the first thing. Making sure that it's tuned well. And, you know, that's even a very subjective thing. What is a well-tuned snare? You know, it's not as objective as like, you know, the E string on your guitar. Like, the E string on your guitar needs to play E. What does your snare drum need to do? I was very fortunate to have been in the room in a bunch of sessions with a really great drum tech named Jordan Gauthier. And when there was time and when it was appropriate, I'd really try to pick his brain on a lot of things. And yeah, from having done that and also just like having put the time in, like, there was a few nights where I was working at Union where, you know, sessions wrapped up early and I just said like, all right, I'm going to grab all five snares that we got and I'm just going to try to make the awesomest sounding snare drum out of each one of these and just grab a tuner and try stuff. So yeah, tuning is super key. A drum tech I am not, and Jordan Gauthier would be a much better hire than me for your drum tech, but I can do it and I know what I want. And that's the first thing to do. And a lot of it comes down to, what kind of snare drum are you trying to get? What's your aesthetic? You going for disco? Okay, well, in that case, let's crank it up, put a towel on it. Like, are you going for like a big long ring? Okay, don't put anything on it. And let's get like a big bell brass snare with fresh heads and let's do that. It's got to sound like the snare you want in the room. The other thing I've learned about drum tuning, so I'll tune a drum, but before I do it, I want the drummer to sit down at the kit and I want to watch them play. And when I'm watching them play, I'm studying very intensely how they're hitting the drums, because that makes a big difference in terms of the sound you get. So I might hit a drum one way and I'll tune for that and get this awesome snare drum for the way I sound. But I found when I was doing that, I was getting in trouble, because when the band's drummer would come in, they would hit the drum differently and I wasn't getting the same sound anymore. It's not necessarily because they're a better or worse drummer. They have different hands than I do. And so, you know, I'm looking at things like the angle that their stick is hitting it at. Do they hit a lot of rim? Are they consistently hitting the center, or are they kind of varying a little bit? And then trying to create a tuning that gets them the sound they want and takes all those things into consideration. That's step one.
I love that.
Order of operations, right?
No, that's such a great lesson too. Like it's such a subtle detail that a lot of engineers don't even think about is like, and that's actually a lesson. It's funny you mentioned like going to Nimbus and working with Garth Richardson there. Like Garth's dad, Jack, was the guy who originally taught me production.
You're kidding. No way.
And so
that's amazing.
And that was one of the lessons Jack taught me was like, watch the drummer, because if you're trying to tune their kit and you're hitting the center of the drum, but they're hitting it off center a little bit, you know, like you got to tune to where they're hitting it, you know, and make sure you understand their mechanics. Yeah.
It's two different sounds. With acoustic instruments, there's so many variables. They're really acoustic instruments are horrible instruments when you think about it compared to MIDI. when if you think about it from a purely technical perspective, a MIDI note going into my MIDI instrument is going to do the same thing every time. But acoustic instruments, they've got all this variability to them. But that's what makes them great. And instead of fighting against it and complaining about it, understand it and get the best out of what they are. So that's a big one. Is tuning and all the nuances of it. It's funny, get it sounding good in the room, but sometimes when you get it under the mics, you start hearing different things too. One thing I find that's really common for me lately is I'll be in the room and I'll hear this like ring on a snare and I'll just be like, ah, that's annoying. I don't want that in there. Put like a few moon gels on it, that sort of thing. And I'll get under the mics. I'll get the drummer to play it inside of the song. So, cause I will, you know, to really judge if you got the right sound, you got to hear it inside of the music. And what happens a lot of the time is just like, hey, can you try taking that one moon gel off? Oh, yeah, that sounds better. Hey, can you try taking the other moon gel off? Oh, yeah, that sounds better. Like, so also judging it in context of how you're recording it as well is really important. In terms of how I record it, phase is huge, huge, huge. I cannot stress this enough. Like anybody listening that maybe doesn't have a lot of like multi-miking or multi-tracking experience, as soon as you put two microphones on one source, you're dealing with a phenomenon called phase, which comes down to like the physics of how sound travels. So a common situation for phase is if you put two mics on a snare drum. So you put one on the top, you put one on the bottom. On the top mic, when you hit the snare drum head deflects downwards. And that downward deflection is going to create a downward sound wave that goes into the microphone. However, on your bottom snare drum, that snare drum head is going to be deflecting towards the microphone. So that's a waveform that's going in the opposite direction. But when you blend those two waveforms together, they actually are fighting against each other. So you have to take one and you have to electronically reverse what's called the polarity to get those two signals to be in phase. I'm sure a lot of people listening already know that, but in case you don't, that's what it is. And I want to talk at length about it because, oh my God, it's important.
I know, I've seen so many mixes of my students where it's like, the drums sound weak and it's just like, just press this button. All of a sudden it's like, holy shit, the drum kit sound massive, you know, like
literally one button. It happens all the time. People send me their multi-tracks and I come in and I'm just like putting the trim plug in with the phase reversal on it. It's just like 2 minutes of just checking phase and they're just like, oh my God, your drum mixes are amazing. It's like, dude, I just got started. Like,
yeah, I just wiped out like the 10 plugins you had trying to EQ that extra low end in there.
Exactly. So phase is key. Like when you're putting multiple mics on it, and you know, I'll use a lot of mics on drums a lot of the time, not necessarily because I'm going to use them all in the mix, but because I want to come home with a bunch of options for the mixing. They all gotta work in phase. So the first thing I usually do is I, you know, bring up the overheads, make sure they're sounding good, make sure I like the stereo image of them, make sure I like sort of the depth of them. If they sound too roomy, maybe I gotta move them a little closer, etc. That'll bring the snare drum mics in. First thing I do, I make sure the top and bottom are out of phase with each other. So I press the phase button on the console, or if you're using a DAW, just put a you know, in Pro Tools, you use the trim plugin. In Logic, you use the gain plugin. There's a little circle with a line through it. That's your phase. So key. Make sure top and bottom are out of phase with each other. If they are, you'll hear an instant improvement in the sound when you flip one. And then take the overheads, bring them up in the mix, and then flip the phase on the overheads. Either one position of the phase or the other position of the phase is going to sound notably better. And if it doesn't, then what's happening is you're 90 degrees out of phase. And that means instead of the overhead sort of being up when the close mics are down, you're kind of like in this weird halfway position, and that's no good either. You actually want to hear, like, when you hit the phase button, that it sounds horrible, and then when you hit it again, it sounds good. If you don't have that, something's got to change. And usually what I'll do when I'm recording it is, if I hear that noticeable improvement or otherwise, great. My phase relationship, I'm very happy with. If I don't hear anything when I flip it, then what I'll do is I'll move the overhead mics just a couple inches up or a couple inches down in whatever direction I think I can still get a good sound from the overheads, but get a better phase relationship with the snare drum. And then go back in the control room, same process again. And usually it's better. So phase. Phase. It's so important.
I love that you described it that way, because, like, yeah, there is often that that, like, in between stage that people are like, what do I do? I guess it doesn't matter, right? But I like how you broke that down. I think that's really important for people to hear.
So it's so unbelievably key. And also, okay, so you got a great phase relationship at your recording. Then if you're, like, self-producing, learn how to maintain that phase relationship through the production and through the editing as well. One common thing I see from a lot of young producers is they'll bring it into Logic and they'll be like, okay, I want to, like, add a snare drum here. And they'll just grab the close snare drum mic and put it in a place. Or they'll do things like, oh, I want to quantize it. And they'll just, like, quantize every microphone of the drum kit separately. When you do things like that, all that work that you put into getting good phase in the recording all of a sudden goes out the window, because now you're moving the waveforms separately and their relative phase position to each other is no longer maintained. I might be losing a few of your, your home recording listeners, but if I did, I would recommend go and read up about phase and get to know everything about it. Because if you can get to know that, your recordings and your productions are going to sound so much better. And it's not just recording. It's also like, even if you're using drum samples, if you're doing any layering, for example, like if you want to have, like, two kick drums, one for some low end and one for some, like, high end snap, same principles apply. Make sure that you get the phase between those two samples right, and make sure you're maintaining that phase relationship throughout the production by whatever means you have to do that.
Totally. I think that's a really good point to bring up too. And that's one thing that I see a lot of people do is, like, they'll, you know, they might use, like, Stephen's Lake Trigger, for example, or maybe they'll manually add samples in or whatever. And then you'll listen to the track and, like, you know, for the most part, maybe everything sounds pretty solid. And then you get a couple notes that just seem like they get really weak just on those ones. It's like, check every single sample that you add and make sure it's in there.
Because think of the time you're going to spend EQing that snare drum to sound like what you want it to be, and it just never is. So, like, take an hour and check that your samples are in phase, and then it's done, and then they're all gonna sound awesome. Trust me, you can take my word for this. I do that. I'm a fiend when it comes to, like, drum sample phase. So yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, like, talking about getting a good snare sound. So I do use samples from time to time when I'm doing a mix. Not to necessarily replace the snare drum that was recorded, but sometimes you just need, like, an unadulterated clean snare with no bleed in it to get some of the characteristics that you want from the snare. A really common one is if you want, like, a really trebly snap to it. If you take your live recorded snare and add a bunch of high-end EQ on it, then you kind of run into issues with cymbal bleed coming into that. again, back to the recording, do everything you can to not get that cymbal bleed. And a lot of that comes down to mic choice, mic angle, polar patterns, things like that. Man, I could go deep on this. You asked me one question about snare drums. I could spend 2 hours on this stuff.
I set you off on the phase topic. let's go.
For real though. Like I mean, and I also want to like be like really intense on it because I feel like a lot of audio tutorials that are out there don't talk about it because it's not like a very glamorous topic. Yep. It's not going to sell plugins. Like, so nobody talks about it, but oh my God, like, get to know it. It's so key. And you're going to get such better sounds and do so much less work to get them by understanding phase and polarity.
For sure.
I was in a very fortunate position where, like I mentioned earlier, that I used to be a mechanical engineer. And so a lot of this like conceptual sciencey stuff, it kind of came like, I had a good like technical grounding to understand these things early on. And that was one thing where, like, you know, I understood physics. And when somebody explained that to me, it's just like, oh, that right there is important. And then they moved on the next day to like some other fancier topic. But that one I really took. I don't always use things like AutoAlign. I think it can be really cool on some things. But with drums, for example, there's also another phenomenon that happens when you put like multiple mics around your kit, like you put some overheads, you put some room mics and all that sort of stuff. So all the different sound sources arrive at different times to those microphones because of the speed of sound is a finite speed and it takes a different amount of time to get to your close mics than it does to your mics that are far away. Even though those time delays might not be perceptible in terms of like, you hearing it and being like, oh, that came in late. There are definitely psychoacoustic things that come into play in terms of like time of arrival at different microphones. And when I'm micing up a kit, I'm thinking about that stuff a lot. So like I've tried to use tools that like phase align things and like bring everything exactly into time to each other and fix what, you know, some people have decided is a problem with multi-miking drum kits. And when I do that, what I find is that all of a sudden the room mics don't feel roomy anymore and I can't put my finger on why. And then as soon as I turn off the tool that put everything in time with all the other microphones, then all of a sudden I'm getting what I want out of it again. And so totally. For that reason, you know, it's kind of a bummer I feel that way because it'd be a lot less work if I just liked the sound of those tools,
totally.
But I don't. And so for that reason, I have to do a lot of that work up front in the recording to make sure my time of arrival choices match from a phase perspective to like the overall picture of the drum kit.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Man, I could go on for a long time.
No, you answered a question that I totally was going to ask you, which was all about like, you know, using tools like AutoAlign because, you know, they make that magical claim. Oh, like we fix your phase issues right away.
Well, they do. They're not wrong.
They mess with your depth and everything you were just talking about there, right?
Yeah. There's, so I got to go to the AES conference in New York last year and, There's an engineer there who I really admire. He's an immersive engineer who records everything in like a native immersive microphone array. So in my studio, I've got a 714 Dolby Atmos speaker array rather. When this engineer, Morten Lindberg, goes out into the field, he brings a microphone array that is seven microphones on the perimeter and four up top. And places the artists around that microphone array and gets them to perform into it and just pans the different sources from the microphones
Interesting.
To the different speakers. And you would think that would be a phase nightmare because of some of the things that I talked about earlier of like, okay, well, you've got microphones facing forward at the front of the array and then you got some facing backwards at the rear of the array. Those are going to be out of phase. But in the end, when you put it all together, because all of this time of arrival stuff and how you hear sound and all these like psychoacoustic effects, they sort of sum together in this microphone array and they create something so realistic and like, so you're just like right in the room when you listen to Morten's recordings. It's really unbelievable. And one of the things he talked about is that happens because of time of arrival at the different microphones. And even though, like, you know, say if somebody's in front of the array and like the center channel microphone is like picking up a lot of sound and the rear microphone's picking up almost nothing, that rear microphone that's picking up almost nothing is what's making the sound sound like it's so in front of you. Like it's such a weird concept. You know, obviously my stereo drum recordings pale in comparison to what Morten Lindberg is doing, but the concepts transfer over for sure.
Of course. Well, that kind of brings me on to another topic that I was curious to quickly ask you about, which is the idea of Atmos. And I know that these days a lot of your work is in Atmos. And so I'm curious to know, like, what inspired you to take that plunge into the Atmos world? Because that's obviously like a lot of the buzz these days. And
Sure. You know, I'd always felt from the beginning of getting into audio engineering that I could never understand, you know, why, for example, the film world has had all these developments in terms of cameras and you know, playback and you know, 3D TVs and all this sort of cool like developments in technology. Meanwhile, like I'm recording on microphones that are literally 70 years old. Not to say they're bad microphones, like we like them for a reason, but like where's the forward thinking with it? I always thought that the audio world undersells itself in that way, that there should be some sort of development that enhances the way we experience music. When immersive audio first came around, the first time I experienced it was, I think it was at the 2019 NAMM show, maybe 2018. And Dolby had this like big kind of like mini cinema in the middle of the floor. And it was one person from Dolby and me. And I sat in and he played like the one Imagine Dragons track that existed as a Dolby Atmos music track. And I thought it was friggin' awesome. And that was that. And it just kind of went away. I didn't hear tell of it for a while. Fast forward to the pandemic. So at this point, I'm like fully working as a freelance engineer. And I was working with this artist named Selena Martin. And we were supposed to record her album in Spain. We had a studio booked out in March of 2020. And I'm sure you can imagine how those plans went. They didn't. So we actually ended up doing the record using Zoom and audio movers. Selena actually happens to be a really good home recorder and a really good self-producer. Has a real knack for choosing sounds that work in the production and then recording herself. You know, and she would ask for advice on like mic technique and how should I do this? How does this sound? And I would be like, okay, try to change this, try to change that, make little tweaks there. And the way we would make the record was, you know, she would record a track. I would assemble those recordings into a master logic session. And we would do like a little bit of mixing, a little bit of production over Zoom using audio movers, rinse, repeat. Like we'd end the session and be like, okay, we need some backup vocals, we need some tambourine, blah, blah, blah. She'd go home and do it, send me the new tracks, do it again. And spent the better part of a couple years making the record that way. It wasn't until the end of the process that Apple Music went online with Dolby Atmos. And that thing clicked again. I was like, Dolby Atmos, I remember that. That's where there's like a bunch of speakers and Imagine Dragons is flying over my head. How is Apple Music delivering that? And then I realized, oh, I can put on some headphones and listen to it. Okay. And I put on a weekend track and I was like, what is, oh my God, that feeling I experienced in like this multi-speaker array is happening in headphones right now. And then I got that demo of the Dolby render and I tried it out and I'm just like, I'm actually putting things over my head. What is going on? I showed Selena at the end of one of our sessions. I was like, hey, check out this Atmos thing. Can I just like show you this for a second? And I did. And her mind was absolutely blown too. And, you know, her sentiment was it was a tool that she'd wished she had her whole career. Like her productions are very extremely layered. There's a lot of sound going on in it. And one of the challenges with her productions is making space for all these sounds and all these ideas. And now we've got a full three-dimensional soundscape. You can have, you know, three background vocals over there doing one thing and like four background vocals up here doing another thing. And all of a sudden they're not fighting with each other anymore. And it's creating this huge, huge soundscape. She totally embraced it. And we ended up finishing the record by mixing natively in Dolby Atmos, but doing it in headphones over Zoom, which in retrospect, I don't recommend doing all the time, but we made it happen. And we, when we did finally get the mixes to a point where we were happy with, she was able to come to Toronto. We rented out a proper 714 studio, checked the mixes there, made some tweaks, and then sent it off to another engineer named Justin Gray for mastering. That was my first experience with it. And I think if I'd never had that experience, I probably wouldn't have taken the plunge and bought a 714 system for the studio. But I was in a very fortunate position where I was working with a super forward-thinking, super creative artist who really had something to say using the technology. And in hindsight, like, I really appreciate her having that attitude and giving me that opportunity, because similar opportunities have been few and far between. Oftentimes Atmos is something you do afterwards. And sometimes I still do encourage that even with my own productions for various reasons. But that opportunity to work with Selena in that way and really deep dive with her, I think is what garnered my enthusiasm for it. And you know, I still have lots of enthusiasm for working in this format.
That's interesting. Yeah. And obviously if you had that experience to know, okay, this is what's possible within this realm, I think that's really interesting. And I think that that's, you know, like for me, like one of the things that has prevented me from going into Atmos is that I deal with a lot of independent artists that have either never even thought about Atmos or don't even know it exists or don't mm-hmm. care for it. Or a lot of people that are just like skeptical of like, do we really need to spend the money on this? And so I'm curious to know, like, when it comes to your Atmos clientele, are you dealing with a lot of like label clients? Is it independent artists? Like, how does that split work for you? Because it seems like from what I see, it seems like it's a lot of label artists primarily that are doing that format.
That's absolutely that's a fair observation, and that's what it's been for me too. It's been mostly label work. I've been very fortunate enough to partner up with Atlantic Records. They send me a bunch of their artists to do the Dolby Atmos mixes for. And depending on the artist, it's, you know, it can range on a spectrum of, we love the stereo mix, just make it a little wider and a little better, to screw the stereo mix, we know all about Atmos, make it a new thing, impress us. So it definitely runs the gamut. That's been the most of my clients, and, you know, probably, I can't speak specifically for them, like, but I'm guessing it's for the reasons you just described, like budget and access reasons. Because looking at it from the perspective of an independent artist, there probably isn't a financial reason to do it. If you're just thinking about it from a pure business perspective, you know, I hate to talk myself out of a bunch of work, but let's be real. Like, even looking at what DistroKid asks for when you go to upload the track, like DistroKid, I think charges like $30 a month to independent artists to have an account. But then if you have an Atmos track, they want $30 a song. And we all know what streaming revenues are like. Like, you might not make that back. Yeah. So for that reason, it's got to be for pure artistic reasons if you're an independent artist. I've tried to do things to make it more economical. For example, I've adopted workflows where we can do both mixes at once. So I'll do your Atmos mix first, and then we'll use a stereo down mix of that Atmos mix as your stereo mix. I'm doing that a lot less these days for varying reasons. I find I'm maybe stretching my creative bandwidth a little bit when I try to do that. Like, I can do it. I figured out how to set up a template in Pro Tools to do it. But I think I've come to the conclusion that I'm stretching myself a little thin, because all that time I'm thinking about, oh, did I route things right? Did I do this? Did I do that? Is mental energy I'm taking away from myself where I could be actually making the vocal sound better. I'm doing that a lot less. Like, that can work if it's a project that requires minimal mixing. So, you know, I come back to the example of like a live jazz thing, like, not that it shouldn't be mixed with care, but I might not, you know, I might not cascade three delay plugins on the bass drum. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
From an independent artist perspective, there's a lot of challenges and a lot of roadblocks that are involved with getting things happening in the format. So when it does happen with independent artists, it happens purely for the love of the format. And it's a mixed bag. Different people have different reactions to it. And it's so funny, like people who I've expected to be really excited about it, in some cases aren't at all. And people who I've expected to like not care about it at all have literally sat in this chair and cried listening to music. It's almost like this, I feel like from what I've seen, it's this inverse correlation of like technical knowledge of the recording process to how much you're going to like Dolby Atmos. And that is, if you're an artist and you know a lot about recording and maybe you self-record and self-produce, you're probably going to hate Dolby Atmos. But if you have never touched a DAW in your life and have no expectations how a recording is supposed to happen, you love it. I mean, that's not a rule, but that's generally the pattern that I've noticed. And I think what it comes down to is when you hear it, it subverts a lot of expectations and a lot of things that you are taught for how music should sound. And if you're approaching it with those expectations and the expectations aren't met, sometimes you're a little let down. Whereas if you just come in with an open mind and no expectations, the whole thing washes over you and it's amazing.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a miracle that I enjoyed it in the first place.
Yeah.
I see the potential of it. The delivery of it just kind of makes sense. The way that they've done like object-based audio, like when that whole thing was explained to me, that was a selling point for me. Just like the idea that, okay, like in a stereo mix, like it's a two-channel file, left speaker, right speaker. The left channel goes to the left speaker. The right channel goes to the right speaker. You have two speakers, it will play back. So I'm mixing on a 714 system, which means seven surround speakers on my level around my ear, one subwoofer, and then four speakers above me. But just because I have those speakers doesn't mean that it's going to be a 12-channel wave file. Because what I'm doing is I'm taking sounds and I'm assigning them to what are called objects. And objects are like audio streams, but they also contain instructions inside of them. And the instructions say something like, at 1 minute, put that sound over my head and a little bit back. And notice how those instructions had nothing to do with what speakers I was listening on. So what ends up happening is on the playback side, whether it's a 714, a 916, a theater, headphones, soundbar, that speaker system is going to be like, oh, he wanted that sound over my head and a little bit back. I have all this trickery to make that happen and I will do it. So the scalability of it is kind of a something that drew me to it as well. Like the way it's delivered makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. It's a very interesting platform for sure.
It definitely is. It's been really interesting working in it. I love doing it and I feel like I'm starting to build an aesthetic with it. When I first started out, it was very like, I can do anything. Let's just do anything. But now I'm starting to settle on like, here's the things I like to do with drums. Here's the things I like to do with vocals.
Makes sense.
You know, got some more longstanding relationship with some artists and some labels in terms of what aesthetic they're going to enjoy and what kind of aesthetic they want. And it's been really fun doing it. And, you know, a lot of people criticize Apple and things like that for not making spatial audio sound good. I feel like if you're working in a calibrated room, your stuff's going to translate on all those different platforms. I've done my best headphone mixes on speakers. Because usually if Dolby stamps your speaker system and they also stamp that soundbar, then the two talk to each other. If you make decisions in here, they're going to scale down and they're going to scale up. I've been generally pretty happy with how that's all been done. I think where you can get in trouble is if you do a mix on one set of headphones and expect it to translate to a cinema, or expect it to translate to another set of headphones even, that's where you get in trouble. And it's a similar paradigm to, you know, like if you're just doing a stereo mix and you mixed only on earbuds, you're going to make it sound great for other people on earbuds, but for people on a full range system, maybe not so much. And not to say when you're mixing on a full range system, you shouldn't consider the people in earbuds, but at the very least, you're experiencing what like the top level ceiling of that production can be. And you're feeling confident that when you scale down from that, it's going to sound good. Anyways.
Yeah, I love it. It's such a deep, it's such a really interesting platform. And obviously, like, we're in the very early days of it still. So people are still figuring out what works and you know, where it's going to get played back. And, you know, the playback technology is increasing every day, you know, like,
for sure.
And so it's very interesting. So, I could chat your ear off, just like we could have a little other separate podcast just on Atmos, but
I know for sure. I could go off on it a lot, but I'm sure there's other things too.
For sure, man. Well, I don't want to take up much more of your time, but if people want to learn more about you and maybe even potentially work with you, what's the best way for them to learn more about you?
So go check out my website. It is audiogamble.com, AUDIO, and then gamble, GAMBLE.com. Or go follow me on Instagram. My handle is audiogamble. I put a up-to-date list on everything I've been working on up on my Instagram, so you can go check it out. Contact me there or contact me through my website. And you can also learn about the studio that I mix out of. It's called Raven Tape Music Room. So I've been mentioning Union Sound Company a lot. That was sort of the first 5 years of my career. Before the last five, I've been sharing a production room with another producer named Robbie Grunwald. And we actually have another one named Bo Cassidy, who's also sharing the studio with us now. And that's where I do all my mixing out of. So I've been freelance and mixing out of this room for the last 5 years. So you go check out, I believe it is raventapemusic.com. Let me actually check that. That's correct. Raventapemusic.com. You can go check out some stuff about the studio.
Amazing. Alex, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And it's been great to learn more about your process. And I can tell that you're very passionate about what you do, and you're very methodical about what steps you take throughout your process. And I think you're very articulate as well with how you explain that process too. So it's definitely gonna be very helpful for the listeners. So thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me. And awesome podcast, by the way. I've really enjoyed listening to it.
Thanks, man. Well, I'll have to have you back on.
Awesome, man.
So that was my interview with Alex Gamble, and I thoroughly enjoyed that conversation. I loved learning more about his process and how he breaks down all of the decisions that he makes throughout the entire process. And I also enjoyed getting him a little fired up on the topic of phase, which I think was great. I think he did an amazing job of explaining the importance of phase and why it matters and how to set up your drums so that you're getting everything sounding in phase, everything sounding really beefy and full, because phase really is one of those things that a lot of people overlook. And then they start adding a million plugins, trying to make their drum sound bigger and whatnot. You don't need all of those EQ plugins to make your drum sound bigger. Really, what you need to do is just press the polarity invert button, and all of a sudden your drums can instantly sound so much more massive, so much more full and beefy. But yet, so many people try to go the difficult way of adding a million plugins trying to make up for it. Save yourself the trouble. Get really good at understanding phase, and when you do that, you'll notice that your drums just can naturally sound significantly better without having to do any additional processing. So focus on that first, but I love that Alex really broke down his process for it. And I also like that he talked about the idea of using tools like Auto Align and how those tools can really mess with your phase and how they can really impact the depth and perceived size of the room that you're recording your drums in. So yeah, I love that he dove into all of that. And I also really enjoyed talking with him about Atmos and how that's going for him. And the whole topic of Atmos, to me, it's a really interesting topic. Personally, I've been kind of hesitant with it because I'm not sure that I believe that it's going to become widely adopted and that consumers are going to want to listen to everything in spatial, or that people are even going to invest the money to get these surround systems that are going to be quite expensive. And then from the independent artist perspective, if you're working with independent artists, sure, Apple has said that they'll pay an extra 10% royalty, I think. But really, like Alex alluded to here, it costs a lot of money to make Atmos mixes. Are your royalties going to make up for that expense of getting this Atmos mix? I'm not sure about it. So until it becomes more widely accepted, personally for me, I think I'm holding off on it. I'm just not sure that it's worth the investment right now. But I can see Alex's perspective here on why a lot of the artists that he's working with are using this and how they're using it as a creative tool. I do think that that is really interesting. I've mixed music before in surround sound, and it is pretty fun. And so I can see how there are lots of different artists that are seeking a more creative way of showcasing their music, and Atmos might just be that method for them.
But I also thought it was really interesting to hear him talk about how most of his clientele is label work. So if you're someone who's thinking, should I get into the Atmos world? I think it's worth thinking about, who is your clientele? Are they labels or are they independent artists who can't afford this? And if they are independent artists who can afford it, do you work with enough people who want this creative three-dimensional space with their mixes? If that is your clientele, then by all means, jump in, right? So yeah, I'm sure you could tell from this little rant here that, you know, I'm just on the fence. But that's not to say that it isn't a valid medium. And I think that it is very cool for the people that are doing it. And I really enjoyed hearing Alex's perspective of this. So yeah, overall, this conversation, I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it. I hope you did too. If you did, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. That way you're notified about all new episodes as they go live each and every Wednesday morning. And at the time of this recording, my brand new book is now out. It's called The Recording Mindset. And this book gives you a step-by-step guide to creating pro recordings from your home studio. So if you're struggling with your mixes, and you've spent days, weeks, hours, months, maybe even years working on your mixes, and you're not quite getting them to the standard that you expect to hear, it might not even be that your mixing skills are the problem. Usually, it's because you're starting off with poor recorded tracks. And this book is going to give you that step-by-step process for how to get the results you want before you even get to the mix. Mixing shouldn't be about transforming your tracks. It should be about polishing them, not correcting them, not fixing them, not making up for bad source tones, all that kind of stuff. Instead, when you have really well-recorded tracks, the mixing process becomes super easy and super quick. So in this book, I break down every single decision you need to make throughout the entire recording process, covering everything from how to set up your instruments to make sure that they sound good, how to choose the right strings, the right picks, how to select the right mics, polar patterns, cables, mic positions, what to do when you're not happy with the mic position you have, how to adjust it to get the sound you want. All of these little details that you have to consider throughout the entire process in order to get the sound you ultimately want. So in this book, I break it down, make it super, super simple for you. And you can literally just take everything in this book. And I guarantee you that you're going to start to make raw recordings that sound much better than some of your best mixes. So make sure to check that out. It's called The Recording Mindset. And if you visit therecordingmindset.com, you can get your copy there. With that said, we've reached the end of this episode. Thank you so much for sticking around to the end. I can't wait to chat with you in the next one. We'll talk soon. Have a good one.
Thanks for listening to the Master Your Mix podcast. To have your questions answered, submit your questions to questions@masteryourmix.com. Please go to iTunes and subscribe and leave a review. And for more information on how you can improve your mixes, visit masteryourmix.com.